Okay, if you would turn in your Bibles to Daniel chapter 8. Now, if you've been keeping up, we're going through the book of Daniel, not in detail, but just kind of to bridge the gap between the minor prophets before the exile and the minor prophets that are after the exile. But Daniel is a special book. Now, Daniel is a prophet that was raised up by God at a special time in the life of Israel. And Daniel was appointed by God to give a clear revelation of God's purpose and God's plan for the ages involving Israel, involving the Gentile kingdoms that were going to be used to judge Israel because of their unbelief, because of their idolatry, and then also looking forward to the end time when the Messianic kingdom would be brought in. So the whole book of Daniel is focused around that. Is giving us a clear picture of God's sovereignty, that God is over all the kingdoms of the world, and God has a specific plan and purpose in place for the kingdoms of the world, and then the kingdom that He's going to bring in, the Messianic kingdom. And the book of Daniel throughout the book is looking toward those things, and especially the end time when God sets up His Messianic kingdom. So every aspect of this book has some pointed to those events that Daniel is being looking at. And what we're learning is that there is a warfare between the kingdom of God and the kingdom of Satan. And you'll see this warfare played out amongst the satanic forces, the demons and the fallen angels versus God's angels. And we're going to see that as we go through parts of the book of Daniel. And that Satan's kingdom is always fighting against God's plan and God's purpose and God's kingdom. But Satan's kingdom is subject to a sovereign God who uses Satan's kingdoms for His own purposes and His own plans. And we see that as we go through the book of Daniel. We've covered the first four chapters dealing with Nebuchadnezzar. And then last week we looked in chapter 7, which was the first year of Belshazzar, who succeeded after two or three kings between Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar's reign. There were two or three kings there. Belshazzar was either the son of Nebuchadnezzar or the grandson, but he is a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar, and he ascends to the throne in about, I forget exactly when he came on the scene. Do y'all remember? You have your notes. In last week when we looked in chapter 7, it was the first year of Belshazzar, which I think was in 553 BC. 553, I believe that Nebuchadnezzar's reign ended in 562 and Belshazzar began in 553. And in 553, if you assume that Daniel was 15 years old when he was taken into captivity, which is the major assumption, in 605, then he would have been 20 years old at the turn of the century there at 600 BC. And so in 553, he would have been 67. Is that right? 67 years old when Belshazzar became ruler of Babylon. And so in the first vision that Daniel had in chapter 7, he was 67. It was the first year of Belshazzar's reign. So now in chapter 8, we are in the third year. It says in verse 1, in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, the king of the king. So here is the second vision of Daniel in the book of Daniel. Of course, the first vision that we had was the vision that Nebuchadnezzar had in chapter 2. And then Daniel had his vision in chapter 7. And now this is the second vision that Daniel's had. And it's in the third year of Belshazzar, which would have been in 551 B.C. And it would have been when Daniel was 69 years old. So you get just trying to give you a flavor for the age of Daniel as he's going through the book of Daniel in looking at these different aspects of his prophecy and his life. So it's the third year of Belshazzar, who is still king of Babylon. And so Daniel chapter 8 is a further explanation and further revelation concerning what Daniel saw in his first vision in chapter 7. Now chapter 7 was a vision that followed up Nebuchadnezzar's vision. In Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2, he had the statue that revealed that there were four kingdoms, the Babylonian, the Medo-Persians, the Grecian Empire, and the Roman Empire. And then at the end of the Roman Empire, there would be the stone that was not cut without hands would come down and crush the kingdoms and set up another kingdom. So that was the thrust of the Nebuchadnezzar's dream. In Daniel chapter 7, Daniel had a vision, and this vision was about four beasts that came up out of the sea, which again represented the Gentile nations, the same four kingdoms, the Babylonian Empire, the Medes and the Persians, the Grecian, and then the Roman Empire. But it gave further detail about the end of that stage of the Roman Empire, including the little horn that came up amongst the ten horns at the end of the age, at the end of the Gentile kingdoms. So here in Daniel chapter 8, we have a second vision 2 years later, in which Daniel gets further information about the first vision that he had, or further revelation. So let's look at it in Daniel chapter 8. So it says in verse 1, "In the third year of the reign of Belshazzar the king, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which appeared to me previously, and I looked in the vision, and it came about while I was looking that I was in the citadel of Susa, which is in the province of Elam, and I looked in the vision, and I myself was beside the Ulaya canal. Then I lifted my gaze and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in front of the canal. Now the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. I saw the ram butting westward, northward, southward, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power, but he did as he pleased and magnified himself." Now this was the first aspect of his vision. He sees a ram, and the ram had two horns. And the second horn was a little bit bigger and came up later. So what's he talking about? Well, he gives us the interpretation over in verse 20. So just turn over to verse 20 in chapter 8 to get the interpretation of the ram. It said, "The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia." So kings of Media and Persia. So if you looked on your map today, the kingdom of Media would have been northwestern Iran. You got Iraq in the middle here. You've got Turkey to the northwest of Iraq. You got Iran to the east and to the northeast of Iraq. The northeastern part of Iran was the Median Empire. The eastern part of Iran was the Persian Empire. And they were both east of the Babylonian Empire. And so if you look at the map today, you got Iraq and you got Iran. And Iran was where the kingdoms of Media and Persia were. Okay, so here you have Babylon that is ruling now. In Belshazzar's time, but the vision is about a coming empire of the Medes and the Persians. And so the ram that is identified in this vision is the identification of what the ram represents is the Medes and the Persians. So the Medes began, because we know that Darius the Mede, at the end of chapter 5, it's Darius the Mede that comes in and overthrows Belshazzar and the Babylonian Empire. The Persians they have an alliance together. The Medes and the Persians are together as one kingdom in its essence, but they're separate. So the Medes are first, and then the Persians are last. The Persians become bigger and more powerful than the Medes, and eventually the Persians take over the whole kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. But the ram is identified as the Medes and the Persians. So it's not like you're left to wonder what these symbols represent. He makes it clear that the ram represents the Medes and the Persians. Okay? Any questions about that? So in chapter 8, when he begins his vision, and he has this vision of the ram. The ram had great power and was the Persian Empire became a very important and very large empire, and no one was able to withstand against whatever the Persians wanted to do, they did. Until, verse 5, it says, "While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes." So here you have a male goat that comes on the scene at the time of the Persian Empire. So if you go down in verse 21, it says, "The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king." So who is the first king of the Grecian Empire? Alexander the Great. He was the big horn. He was the fast moving. When he's depicted as a leopard, and here he says that he that he was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. That signifies how fast he was moving with his armies. So Alexander the Great progressed quickly and swiftly from the west of Greece, is in the southern part of Europe. He went from Greece to all the way to the Persian Empire very rapidly, conquering as he went, and he had a collision with the Persian Empire and defeated them quickly. So that's what it says here in verse 6 of chapter 8. And he came up to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. And I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him. And he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. Okay, so here you have the overthrow of the Medes and the Persian Empire and the setting up of the Grecian Empire started by Alexander the Great. Now, see, when you saw these kingdoms identified in chapter 2, and then you saw the kingdoms identified in chapter 7, and then you give chapter 8 and you get the exact explanation and details about these kingdoms, it is amazing how concise and how perfect the prophecy was. And that's why the detractors from the Bible tried to say that this book of Daniel was written way later than it was written, because it had to be history. It had to be someone that had a understanding of the historical account, because it was so detailed and so exacting. So in verse 8, it said, "Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven." So we know that after Alexander died at a very early age, I think he was probably in his late 20s, 33. Okay, so he died very early in his life. And after he died, the kingdom was split up into four kingdoms. And the four horns represent four aspects of the Grecian Empire. Okay? And then in verse 9, you have where the focus begins to be very important in Daniel's, the rest of Daniel's prophecies is about this little horn. But this little horn is not the final horn, the little horn. This is another little horn that represents the final stage of the Gentile empires. Verse 9, "Out of one of them came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. And it grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the host and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. It even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host, and it removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. And on account of transgression of the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice, and it will fling truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking. Another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, 'How long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply while the transgression causes horror, so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled?' And he said to me, 'For 2300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored.'" So what are we talking about here? Who are we talking about? There's a little horn. No, not this one. That he is a predecessor of the Antichrist. He is a picture of the Antichrist, but this is not the Antichrist. So who is this in history? Antiochus Epiphanes. He was a Syrian. He had the Syrian region of the Grecian Empire. It was divided into four areas, and then out of this Syrian region came this little horn, which was its name was Antiochus Epiphanes. He was a very despicable person. He came into the land of Israel. He was despised. He came into the temple. He desecrated the temple. And this was the first abomination of desolation, or abomination on the temple. He is the one that offered a pig on the altar. And he desecrated the temple. And for 6 1/3 years, the temple was desecrated. So the 2300 days represent 6 1/3 years. It started in September of 131, I believe, B.C., and it extended until December of 125 B.C., the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes over the people of Israel, and this desecration of the temple. So here is what he's talking about there, is this desecration of the temple by the first type of Antichrist, and he represents what the Antichrist is going to be. Now, he is called a little horn. So in Daniel chapter 7, there was a little horn that come up out of the ten horns. So the beast that Daniel saw in chapter 7 represented 10 horns that were going to reign at the same time of the Antichrist at the very end. And the little horn represented by the 10 horns in Daniel 7 is the Antichrist. But this little horn is a predecessor of that Antichrist figure, but he is like the Antichrist. He is a picture of the coming of the Antichrist, and he will do similar things that the Antichrist will do. Okay? So in this vision, he sees this person of Antiochus Epiphanes as a one who created an abomination in the temple for 6 3/4 years, and then when he died, the temple was cleansed. So, to bring that to a parallel understanding of what goes on with the Jewish feast days and celebrations, what is Hanukkah? Why do the Jews celebrate Hanukkah? Anyone know? It's called the Feast of Lights. Why do they celebrate Hanukkah? It's a remembrance, a commemorative of when they cleansed the temple. So now when you hear the word Hanukkah, you can go back to 125 BC, when the temple was cleansed from the abominations that were brought on by Antiochus Epiphanes. And so when he died, they cleansed the temple. They restored the worship in the temple, and it was cleansed and purified, and that is the celebration of Hanukkah. That's why we have Hanukkah, because they cleansed the temple, and that's a remembrance of that. So it kind of brings the historical account of what Daniel is talking about to a thing you can remember when you think about Hanukkah and their celebration at the end of the year, which was when that happened, when the temple was cleansed. Okay? So, then Daniel, he's getting this vision from, this is a vision he received. In verse 15, it talks about the one who brought the vision and the one who gave the understanding of the vision, which was an angel. In verse 15, it said, "It came about when I, Daniel, had seen the vision that I sought to understand it. And behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man. And I heard the voice of a man between the banks of Elea. And he called out and said, 'Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision.' So he came near to where I was standing. And when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. And he said to me, 'Son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end.' And while he was talking with me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and made me stand upright and said, 'Behold, I'm going to let you know what will occur at the final period of the indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end.'" So the purpose for the vision was to give Daniel further insight to the progression of the Gentile kings. But the final purpose of the vision was to explain the indignation that comes at the end. And that was what he had gotten. The first vision was it dealt with this little horn that came up with the ten horns that was the Antichrist and what was going to happen at the end. So even though he's given a vision of what's going to happen with the Medes and the Persian Empire and the Grecian Empire, and he gives a vision of this Antiochus Epiphanes figure, this figure is just a predecessor or a picture or a type of what's actually the purpose of the revelation, is to explain the one that's going to be at the end of times, that's going to be like this Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay, so when he goes into the explanation, besides, this is Gabriel. You know who Gabriel is. Where else do we see Gabriel in the Bible? He announced the coming of Christ. So Gabriel is a messenger to the Jewish people. Now, Michael is the archangel who is the protector of the Jewish nation and the Jewish people. Michael is the chief angel over all God's angels. But Gabriel is a messenger angel that's used of God to bring messages. Was it Gabriel that brought the message to Mary? So here you have Gabriel used in various ways. He is an angelic being that is used by God to be a messenger, and he's the one that brings the message to Daniel about this vision, about the interpretation of this vision that Daniel has had. But the thrust of the vision is found in this last part of the chapter. In verse 21, it says, "The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the little horn and the large horn is between his eyes is the first king, and the broken horn and the four kings that arose in its place represent the four kingdoms which will rise from his nation, although not with his power." Now, in verses 23 through 27, you have a picture of the end of the Gentile kingdoms, which is not the end of the Grecian Empire, but the end of all the kingdoms is what he's reflecting on here. And he's reflecting on the last king that will be of the Gentile nations. In verse 23, "And in the latter period of their rule, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise, insolent and skilled in intrigue, and his power will be mighty, but not his own power. He will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people. And through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. And he will magnify himself in his heart. And he will destroy many while they are at ease. He will even oppose the prince of princes. But he will be broken without human agency. And the vision of the evenings and mornings, which have been told, is true. But keep the vision secret, for it pertains to many days in the future." So here is a leap from the type of the Antichrist, which is Epiphanes, to the reality of the Antichrist, which is going to be there in the last days. So this description here, in some ways, looks at Antiochus Epiphanes and say there's going to be another king that's going to rise up like him, but he's going to be at the end times. He's going to be a different king. He's going to be the one who opposes the prince of princes. So what we have in Revelation 19 is the Antichrist and all his armies are gathered together in the place called Megiddo. We have the Battle of Armageddon, when the forces of the Antichrist are going to face off against the prince of princes, which is the Lord Jesus Christ. And he's going to battle against the Lord Jesus Christ. But it says, but he will be broken without human agency. So what does that mean? Who's going to kill him? Jesus Christ is going to kill him. So he's going to be destroyed by the coming of Jesus Christ. It says here, there's several things about him. His power will be mighty, but not of his own power. Who is empowering this king? Satan has given him power. He will destroy in an extraordinary degree. He will prosper and form his will. He will destroy mighty men, the holy people, and through his shrewdness he will cause deceit. So what does it say in 2 Thessalonians? I want you to tie everything in the Bible together. There's a reason why it's all revealed together. In 2 Thessalonians, what does it say about the Antichrist? It says in verse 9 of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 8, "Then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and will bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. That is, the one whose coming is in accord with the activity of Satan, with all power and signs and false wonders, with all the deception of wickedness for those who perish." So this is the one who says through his shrewdness he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. He will magnify himself in his heart. And so he will be the one that is described as the Antichrist. Now, as you look through the book of Daniel, just to give a reference, and we'll get to some of these a little bit later, but there are many references to this person. The little horn, it says in chapter 7, referring to the same person, the Antichrist. In verse 11 of chapter 7, it says, "Then I kept looking because the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking, I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body was destroyed, given to the burning fire." So here you have a picture of the Antichrist that is speaking boastful words. He's the little horn represented in Daniel chapter 7. Then in Daniel chapter 9, if you'll look in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, this is the one who also forms a covenant with Israel for 7 years. In Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, it says, "And he, the prince that is to come," back up in verse 26, "the prince who is to come is the Antichrist. He will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he will put an end to the sacrifice and grain offerings, and on the wing of abomination will come one who makes desolate, even till a complete destruction, one is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate." So here is a reference again to the little horn in Daniel 7 that is going to create a second abomination on the temple. This is called the abomination of desolation. So at the midpoint of the tribulation 7 years, he's going to come into the temple and desecrate the temple and stop the temple worship and temple sacrifice and put his image in the Holy of Holies, and the people have to worship the image of the beast, which is the abomination desolation. So in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, again, he's talking about this same aspect of what's going to happen at the end. In Daniel chapter 11, he goes on in another vision, and he's talking about this same king again. In verse 36 in Daniel chapter 11, says, then the king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and he will speak monstrous things against the God of gods, and he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. Remember, he was given 42 months to succeed. He's given 42 months to rule. The indignation is the ending of that 42 months, or the ending of the 7 years. So he's given the 42 months to be the actual total dictator of the earth. And so here it says, until the indignation is finished, he will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women, nor will he show regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above them all. But instead, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god whom his fathers did not know, and he will honor him with gold, silver, costly stones, and treasures. He will take action against the strongest of fortresses with the help of a foreign god. He will give great honor to those who acknowledge him. So here you have the Antichrist, who is going to be elevated to be worshipped. He is going to be elevated by the dragon, Satan. He's going to be worshipped. You're going to take the mark of the beast, or you're going to die. And all those who take the mark of the beast will be honored by him because they're worshiping him. So that's the picture in Daniel chapter 11. Then you get to chapter 12, and again he refers to this, again, the same thing. He says in verse 11, from the time that the regular sacrifice is abolished and the abomination of desolation is set up, there will be 1,290 days. So 1,290 days is the length of time of the second abomination that's going to take place. So from the midpoint of the tribulation, when the abomination of desolation is set up, until the end of the tribulation is 1,260 days. So then you have a 75-day period between the ending of the seven-year tribulation and the beginning of the millennial kingdom. So you have 75 days. 30 days into that 75-day period is when Jesus will set up the new temple, and the new temple will be freed from the abomination of desolation. So again, and so here's where you get the 75 days, is the next verse. It says, but as for you, go your way to the end, then you will enter into... It says in verse 12, how blessed is he who keeps waiting and attains to the 1,335 days. So 1,260 days to 1,335 is 75 days. The ones that are blessed are the ones that go into the Messianic kingdom. So there's a 75-day period between the end of the tribulation and the beginning of the millennial kingdom in which a lot of things take place. You have the judgment of the Gentiles, the sheep and the goats. You have the setting up of the new temple, the millennial temple. You have the regeneration of the earth for the millennial kingdom. You have the resurrection of all the Old Testament saints and the tribulation saints. All these things will take place before the kingdom begins. So you have 75 days in which Jesus will accomplish a regeneration of the earth, a cleansing and a setting up of the new temple, and a preparation for the millennial kingdom. But anyway, in all these chapters, the focus is on what happens at the very end with this little horn that is the one that's coming, that was represented by the little horn in the beginning of chapter 8, but he was a picture or a type of the final horn that's going to be the final ruler of the peoples of the Gentiles. Any questions?
Where did you get the 1,260 days from?
1,260 days is in the book of Revelation, and all the way through, it's 1,260 days and 1,260 days. It's 3.5 years and 3.5 years. So there's 1,260 days from the mid. We know that the abomination of desolation occurred at the midpoint, which was 1,260 days in. You got 1,260 days to the end of the 7 years. And so the 1,290 days is 30 days into the 75-day period, 30 days after the second coming of Christ. We'll cover that in more detail when we get to chapter 12. But I just wanted to show you how all these chapters that are coming up have references to this same individual, which is the last ruler of the times of the Gentiles.
This Antipathus, whatever his name is.
Antiquus, Epiphanes.
Yeah. Now, he was a Grecian ruler, and that's when the four Grecian nations, I mean, it was split into four.
After Alexander the Great, The Grecian Empire was split into four. The four generals took over. When Alexander died, four generals took over different portions of the kingdom. And then out of the one portion that was the one that was ruling over the Syrian area, out of that part of the kingdom arose this Antiochus Epiphanes. He was a little horn that rose up in one of the four horns. So there were four divisions of the Grecian Empire, and the part that was in Syria, that was one of the four divisions, he rose up out of that. He was a Syrian that came down to Jerusalem. Okay, so in our chronological sequence of the book of Daniel, let's go back to Daniel chapter 5 to bring in the end of the Babylonian Empire. So this is, if Belshazzar reigned for 14 years, and Daniel's vision came in, the second vision came in the third year, so this is 9 years later, you have the writing on the wall, the handwriting on the wall. So in Daniel chapter 5, we have the story of the handwriting on the wall. We won't spend a lot of time on that because it's a story you're all familiar with, but we will go through and look at a couple of things that we want to point out. Verse 1, Belshazzar, the king, held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of the 1,000. When Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold, silver vessels, which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, in order that the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank the wine and praised the gods of gold, silver, and bronze, iron, wood, and stone. So here you have a situation where the king of Babylon has taken out the utensils of the temple of the God of Israel. Now that's very significant. He's taken the very utensils that were used to worship the God of Israel, and he in effect is saying, my gods are greater than your God. And to demonstrate that, we're going to actually use your objects of worship to worship our gods. And so very arrogantly, very blatantly, he is saying, my gods are greater than your God. And he's demeaning the God of Israel. The sacred utensils that were in the temple, he's using to drink wine out of and to have his debauchery and his idolatrous time of feast days and worships and to his own gods. Verse 5, suddenly the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Then the king's face grew pale, and his thoughts alarmed him. His hip joints went slack, and his knees began knocking together. The king called aloud to bring in the conjurers, the Chaldeans, the diviners. The king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me will be clothed with purple and have a necklace of gold around his neck and have authority as third ruler in the kingdom. So, none of the king's wise men could do that. So the queen enters the hall in verse 10. Because of the words of the king and the nobles, and the queen spoke and said, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is a spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of your father, illumination, insight, and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, the conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belshazzar. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation. So here you have a situation. Daniel, after he had given Nebuchadnezzar the interpretation of his dream, was elevated over all of the wise men of Babylon. So evidently, when Belshazzar took over, Daniel was demoted and not anywhere to be seen as far as overseeing the wise men of Babylon any longer, because he's just been neglected or put aside. And so Belshazzar didn't even know about Daniel from that standpoint, and he sure was not in a position of being used by Belshazzar and consulted by Belshazzar at all. So again, this timing of this is 9 years after Daniel had his second vision of the reign of Belshazzar in the third year of Belshazzar. So this is at the very end of Belshazzar's reign, the end of the Babylonian Empire. And so this time period of this is 539 BC. So at this point, Daniel would be 81 years old. So in 539 BC was the ending of the Babylonian Empire, and this is the time frame for this occurrence of the handwriting on the wall is in 539 BC. So Daniel would be at the age of 81 at this time. It says in verse 13, Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, are you that Daniel who is one of the exiles from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? So he doesn't know Daniel. He obviously hasn't had any... Daniel hasn't been used by him at all. Verse 14, now I have heard about you that a spirit of the gods is in you, and that illumination, insight, and extraordinary wisdom have been found in you. Now, again, I want you to just listen to what Daniel's words are describing about God that Nebuchadnezzar came to understand and learn, and it is completely repeated over and over throughout this book of Daniel about understanding who God is. I saw a commercial on TV this week about I think it's a Volkswagen commercial about doing something to save the planet, and they show this picture of the planet from outer space, and it's just, and I'm thinking here, all these people in the world, they're looking at this ball, this sphere, that's floating in space, and in the midst of this entire universe, you have this little ball sitting in space that we're living on, and we think we're controlling the destiny of this ball. I mean, the absurdity of thinking that we have any control over what happens on this planet when the creator of the planet is sustaining and keeping it. 1 degree of temperature that he decides to turn up from the sun has more impact on the climate and the impact of the earth than anything we could ever do. 1 volcano has more impact than anything we could ever do. But I'm just saying, the creator is the one who sustains it and is in charge of it, and we're looking at this like we have control over our own destiny and control over this planet. Just looking at the when you think about it, we're sitting on a ball that's sitting in the middle of a universe, just floating around in universe, and it just happened to be there, and we just happen to be here with no concept that there's a purpose and a reason that all this happens. But that's what Daniel's referring to here. He says, This Belshazzar says that he will give him the authority as third ruler in the kingdom. In verse 17, Daniel answered and said before the king, keep your gifts for yourself or give your reward to someone else. However, I will read the inscription to the king and make the interpretation known to him. O king, the Most High God granted sovereignty and grandeur and glory majesty to Nebuchadnezzar your father, and because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished, he killed, and whomever he wished, he spared alive. Whomever he wished, he elevated, and whomever he wished, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was disposed from his royal throne, and his glory was taken away from him. He was also driven away from mankind. His heart was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling place was that of the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle, and his body was drenched with dew of heaven until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind, that he sets it over whomever he wishes. Yet you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew this, all this. So Belshazzar knew about what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. He knew that he had been humbled by God. He knew that Nebuchadnezzar praised the God of heaven and acknowledged that the whole point was because of his pride and that God elevates the humble. And yet Belshazzar rejected all that information that he had, and he went in his own way. He says, you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your nobles, your wives, your concubines have been drinking wine from them. You have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see and hear or understand, but the God in whose hand are your life breath and your ways you have not glorified. Then the hand was sent from him, and this inscription was written out. So the handwriting on the wall was from the Most High God. It was from God above that wrote this message to give you a message. And this is the message. The inscription that was written out, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. I don't know how you pronounce those words. But this is the interpretation of the message. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. So the first part of this handwriting on the wall is that your kingdom is finished. Your kingdom is done. I'm taking your kingdom away. Now, this was prophesied by Habakkuk and the other prophecies that Babylon was going to be raised up by God to judge Israel. Then God was going to judge Babylon. And so this is a fulfillment of what was prophesied earlier, but it's because of the actions of Belshazzar. So here's an example of how God has a sovereign purpose and plan. He's going to judge the Babylonians, but he responds to the actions of an individual that carries out his judgment. So that's the same way that happens throughout history. God has a purpose and a plan. He raised up Pharaoh to be there to do what he's doing, but Pharaoh did what was in his heart to do, and God judged the Egyptians because of the actions of Pharaoh. So all these times, God raises up people to carry out his purpose and plan, but then he responds to their actions to do what he did. Just like when Pilate put Jesus on trial and then condemned him to death. But it wasn't Pilate that did that on his own. It was ordained of God. But Pilate still acted out of his own heart to do what he did. And that's the way God does in his carrying out his purpose and plans. It's always with people that do what they do that carries out the plan of God. The second writing was Tekel, you have been weighed in the scales and found deficient. In other words, you have been judged and condemned of God. Your actions and your attitudes of arrogance and pride have been weighed and judged of God, and you have been found lacking or wanting in any standing before God that would be acceptable to Him. So you've been judged, and therefore personally you're going to be taken out. And then first, the last one is Perez. Your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. And so that is the declaration to Belshazzar. And so then, verse 29, Belshazzar gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck and issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as third ruler in the kingdom. Now, that didn't last long. So when Daniel said, you give it to whomever you please, what he was referring to is, I understand what's happening. It doesn't mean anything for me to maybe be made third ruler in the kingdom. In fact, it may be a bad thing, because if the Medes and Persians come in and they want to kill out all the rulers of Babylon, I may be subject to being killed. So he was elevated for a very short time, because the same night, verse 30, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at the age of 62. Now, in some of your commentaries, you'll see that some people try to say that Darius and Cyrus the Persian are basically the same person, and that Darius is just a title and Cyrus is a name. I just disagree with that, because Darius the Mede is given throughout Daniel, and Cyrus is the king mentioned throughout Daniel also. And if it was the same person, I don't see why that they would be using different terms for the same person when it's not consistent with Scripture. So we know it was the Medes and the Persians, and it seems like that the Medes were the first that came in and supplanted the Babylonians, but that the Persians grew and grew in more power. So there was an alliance between the Medes and the Persians, but the Persians became more dominant as the time went. They were the larger of the two horns, and by the time that the empire ended, it was a Persian empire, and the Medes had become less in power and stature amongst that kingdom. So Darius the Mede came in and overthrew the Babylonian empire and delivered the kingdom up to the Medes and the Persians. So Daniel, at this time, is 81 years old, and now he is going to be under Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian kings for the last few years of his life. Okay, we'll stop there this week. And then next week.